So we'll take up the matter of Roger Leroy Willett Jr. against Stacy Renee Lee, formerly known as Stacy Renee Willett. Mr. Weisbrot, you can come right up to the podium. Would you like to reserve any of your 15 minutes for rebuttal?
I would, Judge. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes. I don't think I'll take my whole 15
All right.
minutes here.
Yeah.
So,
whatever you don't use, you can use in rebuttal if you wish. So, you
All right.
can proceed when you're ready.
Thank you, Judge. Please, the court. This matter is actually fairly simple. The question before the court today is: did the court err in not grant my motion for under 428C to leave to appeal or to enter a new order because of the delay in notifying me of the entry of the order from the hearing we had on this matter? As I stated in my brief, I signed the order and took it to the counsel's office. At that point, I tried to keep track of things the best I could. I did not see anything that the order was entered until it arrived, and it arrived at my office on December 4th.
Well, let me ask you this, counsel, because
sure.
the circuit court ruled that, in effect, there was a substantial compliance with the statute because you endorsed the final order and should have expected it would be entered shortly thereafter. Why is that error?
Well, Judge, I expected the order to be entered shortly thereafter, but I read the statute, and as I pointed out in my brief in the Zhao and Ford cases, that the 30-day time, I read the 30-day timeline to be an absolute, and that's the way I've been treating it for my entire career. You have to do it within 30 days. You have to file your notice of appeal within 30 days of the entry of the order.
It's pretty draconian rules.
It is. It is, Judge, and there's no room for error on that. But the court, I had no way of knowing when the court received the order. There was no affidavit of receipt, as is typically in there.
Counsel, is there anything, though, that would have prevented you from either checking the court website and or calling the clerk's office to determine whether the order had been entered?
I did check the court website, Judge. There's nothing preventing me from that. But that only tells me the date that the entry, the order was entered.
Did you check it? Was it checked prior to that?
It was checked in early November.
Okay.
But it was, I have to admit, you know, at that point I was facing a major surgery and, you know, I may not have checked as many times as I should. I made phone calls to opposing counsel's office, which were not returned. Of course, they have no obligation to return my phone calls. But I did inquire about the order. And I immediately contacted several appellate attorneys that I knew on what motion to file, and they suggested the motion I filed under 8.01428C and for a new order. Court believed I didn't do due diligence, but as I stated in the brief, I look at the statute in its entirety, well, not a single.
The statute phrase. Actually permits you to file a notice of appeal prior to the entry of the final order. It just doesn't become effective until the final order is entered.
And somewhere I may have missed that, Judge, but I've always believed that you had to file that notice of appeal after the entry of the order. And that's when I believe the timeline runs. It may not be effective. The court did articulate that I could have filed that notice of appeal prior to that, but I've never seen that rule, and in all honesty, and I just I took it as 30 days from the entry of the order, and that's what I was planning on. I looked at the statute in its entirety. I didn't focus on one part, and so I filed the motion to grant leave to appeal or to enter a new order so that I could.
Well, Rule 5A:6, which is our rule,
yes, sir.
Says, quote, a notice of appeal filed after the court announces a decision or ruling, but before the entry of such judgment or order is treated as filed on the date of and after the entry. In other words, what I just said.
It is.
And that's our rule. It's, of course, been promulgated and is available for anybody to want to read. So
it is, Judge. But in my mind, it was, I had to see it as after the entry of the order. That's the way I've always dealt with these matters, and whenever I've noticed an appeal to the court.
What governs the mailing of the court order, the trial court's order entered to counsel? Is it rule, or is it policy, or is it law?
The statute requires a timely notice, but it doesn't I found nothing in the statute.
Nothing in your court that says anything about when and how it should be mailed or anything of that sort?
No, Judge, it doesn't. It doesn't say it has to be certified or when received. It just says...
It says timely notice.
Timely notice. And that... My point...
So your argument is, I think, implied that that requires that it be... that be mailed in time for you to meet the requirements for appeal.
That is correct, Judge. That is my belief. And
so, counsel, doesn't that shift, though, the notice onus to the court?
Well, the court does have an onus. They do have an obligation of timely notice to the parties and to counsel. And I believe that's what the statute
is. Is the judge's indication that they're going to enter the order or their ruling not that notice?
I'm sorry, I don't follow the question,
Judge.
If the
court on the hearing date indicates how it's going to rule and that it's going to enter the order that's being forwarded, isn't that notice?
It is, Judge. And I am, in the record, I, you know, asked the court to note my exception to the ruling. I fully planned on an appeal at that point. Took about a month for the order to get circulated, and then it was sent off to Judge West. Judge West, I might point out, is not a normal sitting judge in the court. He was a substitute judge. So I have no way of knowing when the court received the order. They could have received the order November 4th, they could have received it November 26th, the day before they mailed it. I just have no way of knowing. And normally there is an affidavit in the court record of receipt of these orders. And in this case, there is nothing in the court file. And I alluded to that in my brief.
Receipt of the signed, executed order? Is that what you're saying? You get notice of the receipt of the executed order?
That's correct, Judge. The court gets notice.
Help me under... Excuse me?
There's an affidavit normally in the file of when an order is received by the court.
But are there instances in your court when the judge doesn't sign it for weeks on end?
Yes, Judge. Look, there are many incidents.
But a trial judge in Vermont.
I'm aware of a lot of circuits where there's a lot of long delay.
There are delays.
There are.
Let's put it that way.
And the court...
Okay.
I'm sorry for interrupting,
Judge.
No,
I think I got it.
Yeah. As I said, the website only tells you when the order was entered. It does not tell you when the order was received.
Well, one of the things the circuit court here noted in your hearing before it was that it could find no statutory or requirement in any rule that required the clerk to basically notify counsel when an order had been entered. Do you have any issue with that? In other words, can you dispute that? Can you find some authority for that?
Judge, the only authority I had has the statute where it says that there must be notified by any means, and that's in the preamble of 801.428C, where it states failure to notify or counsel a final order if counsel is a party or not represented by counsel.
Well, I mean, it seems to make sense, that if the court says, here's my ruling, announces it from the bench, so you know who prevailed, and you know an order is going to be entered to that effect, and you don't, if you're not the prevailing party, you don't take any action to ask for a rehearing or a stay or some other action by the trial court, it seems reasonable to me to expect that that order is actually going to be entered in a, you know, whenever the court, you know, gets around to it, hopefully in a fairly timely fashion. But in any event, as I just indicated, from that point on, you can certainly note your appeal without any, you know, without any detriment.
Yes, Judge, but pardon me for a second. A motion for a rehearing or any post-trial motion, those motions don't stay that 30-day rule.
No, my only point is simply that, and you're getting into your rebuttal time, but I'll give you a little bit extra if I need to, but my only point is simply that it seems to be a reasonable expectation that if you didn't prevail, you know, then you'd be the one most likely to ask for a rehearing, and if you have no plans to do that and have no plans to ask for a stay, then the expectation would seem to me be reasonable that you would expect the court to then timely enter its final order that reflected the ruling you just heard it announced from the bench.
Well, I did expect that, Judge.
Okay.
I absolutely expected a timely entry. I've discussed it with my client, and...
Well, were you prepared for appeal I mean, I'm not asking you to disclose what you spoke with your client with, but I guess I'm thinking more generally that there are times when you're not ready to appeal right after the entry, right after the decision. Doesn't that take, it takes filing something, does it not?
It does. It takes filing a notice of appeal.
Yes, and that's attorney time and drafting something that will qualify. So
and you could also ask for an extension on filing the notice of appeal if you don't think you're ready to do so either.
Well, Judge, I had a notice of appeal ready to go.
Yeah. Okay.
All right. It just seems to me that there are two issues here, whether you comply with our rules or whether the circuit court gave you timely notice. And I don't know that the intent, that's what I'm looking at, is the intent to foreclose, I mean, to confine you to one approach to this, i.e., you file the appeal the minute the decision is made on the bench, or can you wait for the time that is permitted under our rules, which is a 30-day rule?
I believe I had to wait for that 30-day rule, Judge.
Mr. Weisbrod, Judge Lindsay on, and I've asked you a lot of questions into your rebuttal time. I'm going to give you the full 5 minutes.
All right. Thank you, Judge.
Right. Mr. Gibson?
Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Ken Gibson. I represent Stacy Lee in this matter. And this case really comes down to two critical questions. The first is Mr. Willett's assignment of error defective? Second question is, was the trial court correct in ruling that Mr. Willett failed to meet the strict requirements of 8.01-428C?
Well, isn't this an issue of our jurisdiction? In other words, if the notice of appeal hasn't been properly perfected, then we lack jurisdiction. Isn't that the ultimate point here?
Your Honor, I would respectfully disagree. I think the appeal is properly perfected, improperly perfected by opposing counsel, but it is properly before this court.
Well, we certainly have the jurisdiction to determine our own jurisdiction.
Yes, sir.
And that's, I think, the posture this case is in. We have to determine whether we have jurisdiction because of the defect in the or the alleged defect in the notice of appeal process.
Ms. Lee is not disputing that Mr. Willett could not properly appeal the ruling of the trial court regarding this appeal issue. So that is properly before the court in Ms. Lee's position. Concerning the standard of review for the second question, it would be, was the trial court plainly wrong or without evidence to support its decision? I'll address the assignment of error issue first. Under 5A12C1, Mr. Willett was required to list clearly and concisely the specific errors in the ruling below upon which he intended to rely. And if it lacked specificity, then under this rule, the appeal should be dismissed. There are several supporting cases that I cited in my brief that would hold that this assignment of error is defective. This assignment of error, at its heart, essentially says the trial court erred in denying my motion. That's it. And under the Carroll case, Supreme Court of Virginia...
Let me stop you again, Mr. Gibson, because I'm trying to avoid putting the cart before the horse here. I take your point, but before we can get to that point, it seems to me we've got two other points we have to deal with. First of all, and in probably in reverse order, I guess it would be the lack of a transcript that we can look at to determine exactly what transpired in the trial court, number one. But then, as I indicated earlier, you know, do we have any authority to act on this case at all if the notice of appeal wasn't properly filed? Or if it wasn't, I should say it wasn't timely filed. Because if it wasn't, then it seems to me there's plenty of case law that suggests we have no authority to act at all. It doesn't matter whether the trial court erred or not if we have no authority to correct it. I'll put it that way.
Yes.
So it seems we need to deal with that last issue first, because if we can't get past that, it's stop, do not pass, go, do not collect $200, we're done.
I would certainly welcome that determination, Your Honor. Hedging my bets, I wanted to...
Well, I don't blame you for that. I'm not suggesting you stop with that, but you haven't even dealt with that, and I'm suggesting that maybe that's what we obviously discussed with your opponent here, so... and we have
yes.
to, you know, of course, obviously, if we get past that, then we have to deal with how do we say the trial court erred if we don't know what the trial court did other than deny the motion.
I would certainly welcome that ruling, Your Honor, that the appeal wouldn't be properly before the court. I think in giving credence to my opponent's argument, there was a final order entered in January 2018 regarding that issue, and that order itself would appear to be an appealable order. And so if the court would conclude that the January 2018 order concerning the status of this appeal was a valid final order, then I would concede that Mr. Willett had the right to appeal that issue. I would agree that the underlying issue of the termination of spousal support that was addressed on September 22, 2017 is not before this court and should not be ruled on. So I think...
Okay.
I'm in agreement with you.
I'm not unsympathetic to Mr. Weisbrod's position because, I mean, there's you know, you act, you wait for the court to enter an order, but, I mean, obviously the rule says what I quoted, but I mean, it's not unreasonable in the abstract to expect to be notified at some point of what the court's action is, ultimately.
Correct. However, the code section 8.01-428C is what I would consider a statute of last resort, a Hail Mary pass in the football context or in the religious context. And if you're going to throw a Hail Mary pass, you've got to get it right. You've got to throw it.
I think only at Notre Dame are they actually congruent.
True. Touchdown, Jesus. So there are three requirements for that code section. A litigant has to meet each of these three requirements or the Hail Mary is dropped in the end zone. The first is there has to be a lack of notice by any means. And the trial court was correct, is we don't have to mail the order to you. It's notice by any means. And so in this particular case, we do have notice by any means because the order was mailed to Mr. Weisbrod. He received it on December 4th, which was under Code Section 1-210, the 30-day deadline was extended to that Monday, which was Monday, December 4th. So he did receive notice by any means. To your earlier comments, he knew for 72 days that this was an appealable issue. From September 22nd to December 4th, when his appeal expired, he knew that the trial court had ruled against him. But that leads me to the second requirement, perhaps the most important, is the General Assembly said, if you're going to take advantage of this statute of last resort, you have to act. You have to take affirmative action. You have to exercise due diligence in determining notice. And this Supreme Court in Virginia has held under Dennis versus Jones that due diligence is the devoted and painstaking effort to accomplish an undertaking. That's a high burden. That's not checking in periodically with the court. That is, in this case, he could have done several things. He could have called the clerk's office. He could have physically examined the court file to determine if the order was entered. He could have reviewed the Supreme Court website and the pleadings log for this particular case. And lastly, Mr. Willett's counsel, unfortunately, and I know these things happen, but he didn't update the court with his address of record. The last pleading he filed was an address in Yorktown, George Washington Memorial Highway. The only effort he made to correct that address was to scratch that out on the order that's an issue before the court and put a P.O. box. He did not write a letter to the court to say, this is my new address. And what happened is when the court mailed the order to Mr. Willett, it got forwarded to the new address, the new P.O. box, which was a delay caused by the lack of due diligence. I also note concerning this issue, the case school board of the city of Lynchburg that interpreted a former version of this statute and said, you rely on communications from the clerk's office at your peril. And the attorney in that case asked the clerk, is this order entered? She said, no, not yet. But it actually had been. And so they were unable to file an appeal on time. And the court said, no, that's not good enough. You should have looked into the court's file. Here, we have no evidence regarding any due diligence. I'm sympathetic to counsel's argument today and facts that he was facing a surgery and that he made some phone calls to my office, but that's not in the court's record. And it was his burden of proof. The case I cited, Buchholz PC, Supreme Court case 1988, talks about the burden of proof. It is axiomatic that the failure to produce evidence on an issue is held against the party having the burden of proof, not against the party that does not have the burden of proof. So Mr. Willett was in a position to file affidavits to accompany his motion, and he did not do that. And so the court believed that it had sufficient facts before it to make a decision and chose not to. Regarding the last element of 8.01-428C, the lack of notice has to deny the litigant an opportunity to appeal. He had the opportunity to appeal because he received it on December 4th within the time frame within which he could have filed a notice of appeal. He notes today he had the appeal ready to go. Yorktown's about a 20-minute ride to the Gloucester Courthouse, so it was physically possible for him to file that. Circling back to the assignment of error issue, I would ask this court to dismiss the case because the assignment of error is defective. The courts have talked about the purpose of being specific in your assignment of error is to give the opposing party and the court notice of the specific issues that are going to be litigated. And there's a whole litany of cases where the court said you're not being specific enough, and because of that, your appeal regarding the assignment of error is to be dismissed. I think that probably the most analogous case here is Westlake versus Property, Westlake Properties, Virginia Supreme Court, 2007, where they would not entertain an assignment of error in which the assignment of error was the trial court erred in denying my motion for mistrial on other grounds. So he's identified the motion that was denied, added this superfluous on other grounds, and the court said we're not going to entertain general and unspecific assignment of error. Well, in this case, we don't even have a superfluous phrase at the end on other grounds. We have no specificity, and that is analogous to the Carroll versus Commonwealth case, Supreme Court, Virginia, 2010, where the assignment of error was rejected because the litigant said the court violated the terms of the plea agreement in its ruling regarding the defendant's sentence. And the court said it was insufficient because the assignment of error didn't even use the term plea agreement, didn't use the term breach. And so here we would expect terms like notice, due diligence, mailing, and the code section to alert this court and opposing party concerning the nature of this error. And so it is Ms. Lee's position that the assignment of error is defective and can be dismissed on those grounds. If there are no other questions, that concludes my argument.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Gibson. Mr. Weisbrot?
Thank you, Judge.
You have 5 minutes.
Your Honor, I'll deal with the assignment of error question first. After the time had run for appeal of the trial, the post-trial motion was to enter a new order or grant leave to appeal. That was the only appealable issue at that point. So it meets the statute that it denied Mr. Willett's right to appeal because the merits on the trial, that appellate, that time had run. The post-trial motion to enter a new order or grant leave to appeal, that's in the assignment of error, and I believe that's sufficient to meet the requirement of that. And with regard to the address, Judge, I've stated in my brief, I'm not asserting that. I'm saying the issue was timely notice. Did I know that the court had ruled against me? Of course I did. Was I prepared to appeal it as soon as I knew the order was entered? Yes, I was. But I did not file it with the court prior to the entry of the order. I concede that I did not do that. But again, as I stated, I relied on the 30-day rule, which to me meant it had to be after the entry of the order. And the only appealable avenue left was to file the motion under 8.01428C for the entry of a new order or grant leave to appeal. That's an assignment of error. That's what's before the court today, and I believe it's properly before the court.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Weisbrot. We will come down and greet counsel and take up the matter of Thomas versus Commonwealth.